Phariseeism versus Jesus' teaching. The 25th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 20th, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I have a handout I'm going to pass around. Rather than proceed on through Luke, I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, and I want to pause and stop and respond to an email that I got in response to last week. But before I do that, I got two emails last week. One of them caught me in a very, very embarrassing mistake. There's two parables in the passage that we looked at last week. The other thing I'm more embarrassed about is I don't have a Bible today. So I'm going by memory here. But there are two parables in the passage last week. One was the parable of the garments, and the other is the parable of the wineskins. And if you look at Matthew and Mark, their account of the parable is slightly different than the account in Luke. And my comments about that parable, brief and sparse as they were actually informed more by the version in Matthew and Mark than they are by the one in Luke. I think the accounts are mutually compatible. I don't think they're inconsistent with one another, but the version in Luke is a little bit more complete. And what Luke says is, if you take a patch off of a new garment, the other passages don't have the feature of actually cutting the patch out of a new garment. They just talk about new cloth, using new cloth to patch an old garment. But in the Luke account, it's if you cut a patch out of a new garment and sew it onto an old garment that you both wreck the new garment that you just cut the patch out of, as well as, and then he simply says, and the new patch is incompatible, basically, with the old garment. Matthew and Mark go on to stress that incompatibility of the new patch with the old garment, in that the new garment of made of unshrunk cloth will actually tear the old garment. So I think probably Jesus' original parable was more complex and involved all of that. Matthew and Mark emphasize one aspect of the parable, and Luke is emphasizing the other aspect of it. All of them are simply trying to, I mean, the whole parable, I think, is simply trying to make the point that out of your paradigm, out of your set of beliefs that define how you understand God, how you understand your relationship to God, how you understand the law, how you understand righteousness, and all those things that are important to our relationship with God, the set of beliefs out of which you understand those things are going to lead to the actions that you take in life and the practices that you adopt in your life. And the practices and actions that are derived from and arise out of one paradigm are not necessarily going to be at home in another paradigm, that your actions and practices must match your paradigm. So you can't just come along, and I think the point he's making to the disciples, because if you remember the question was, the disciples of the Pharisees and of John the Baptist fast. Why don't your disciples fast and pray? Why don't your disciples do likewise? And Jesus' response to them, I think, is, well, I have come along, and in my teaching, I am leading them to understand their relationship with God according to a new paradigm. And you can't just take the practices and actions that were at home in another paradigm, in a different paradigm, in what he's calling an old paradigm, the paradigm of the Pharisees. You can't just take the actions and practices that arise out of that Pharisaical paradigm and kind of slap them on the lives of my disciples who are being taught to understand life in a radically different way. It just doesn't work. Ultimately, the actions and practices of the Pharisees are going to be destroyed by this new paradigm. They're going to be nullified and negated by this new paradigm. I think that's ultimately the point that he's making. But the way I articulated it last week was not in keeping with the actual passage that we were studying, so I needed to correct that. The other thing that came up was, I don't remember where I said it, whether it was in the question and answer session or at the end of my presentation or both. But the way I was heard to have said something to this effect, and I can't vouch for the fact of whether I said it or not because I don't know, but the leaders of contemporary evangelicalism abhor the true gospel. They are afraid of it and want no part of it. If Jesus were to arrive on the scene today, they would repudiate him. And the email is asking me, in effect, I think, to defend that, or do I really mean that? How much am I willing to stand by that? Well, I don't want to defend the comment because I don't even know exactly what I said. But let me respond by clarifying what I intended to say, whether I did or not. And I want to discuss that at greater length. And then that leads me to what I want to spend most of my time on today, and that is I want to explore in depth the different paradigms, the paradigm of the Pharisees as over against the paradigm of Jesus that he was teaching his disciples. And that's what your handout is. I want to go over that. And then if we have time, I want to raise the question. It's really not for me to answer. I ain't no prophet. It's not really for me to answer what the current state of affairs is. So I will just leave you with the question and love to have you kick it around. Is modern evangelicalism today more in line with and at home with and more like the paradigm of Jesus, or is it more at home with and more like the paradigm of the Pharisees? I don't have anything at stake on that. I would love for it to be true that we are more in line with the paradigm of Jesus. I would love for that to be the case. I fear that it's not the case, and that's where my comments were coming from last week. Well, let me clarify my point to start with. I think what I intended to say can be summed up in two points. First, the paradigm that informs the culture of Bible-believing evangelical Christian culture is a different paradigm of Christian truth than the paradigm that informs the teaching of Jesus and the apostles. And let me underline the word culture. And then secondly, that paradigm that informs the culture of evangelical Christianity is incommensurate with and inimical to the paradigm of biblical Christianity, in the same way that the paradigm of the Pharisees was incommensurate with and inimical to the paradigm of Jesus. Okay, those are the two points I was trying to make. Whatever comment I made regarding the leaders of evangelicalism or most evangelicals or whatever it is that I said, what I was trying to illustrate is, I think, the culture of evangelicalism today that informs evangelicalism would reject Jesus. So does that mean that every evangelical would reject Jesus? Well, no, of course not. I mean, if you look carefully in the book of Acts, there were a significant number of Pharisees who became disciples of Jesus eventually. Not even all the Pharisees rejected Jesus. But the question is, did the Pharisees embrace Jesus because Jesus supported them in the paradigm that they had been enculturated into, or in spite of the fact that Jesus' paradigm was different? I would argue it's the latter. They didn't become Jesus' disciples because Phariseeism had prepared the way, in a sense. In one sense it did, of course. Judaism prepared the way for Christianity altogether. But the distinctives of Phariseeism did not prepare them to hear the message of Jesus. They had, by becoming disciples of Jesus, they had to undergo a paradigm shift. They had to reject that which they had been enculturated into and embrace an entirely new paradigm. So would every evangelical today, if confronted with the Messiah Jesus, would they reject Jesus? No, of course not. I wouldn't pretend to say that for a second. But would they have to go through a paradigm shift in order to do that? I think they would. Because it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the culture of evangelicalism is incommensurate with and inimical to the understanding of spirituality that Jesus is trying to teach us. We need to keep in mind across the board, not just listening to me, but listening to one another in public discourse today, the logic of generalization. I'm constantly hearing people attempt to refute a generalization by saying, no, I know somebody of whom that's not true. Well, yes, but the logic of generalization is that when you say all of somebody is something, you don't mean it, each and every one of them when you're generalizing. Of course there are exceptions. We all understand that. We all, without generalization, we couldn't reason the way we want to reason about the world. We have to generalize in order to make sense out of our world. There's nothing immoral about generalizing. There may be something immoral about stereotyping, if by stereotyping we mean taking a generalization and assuming that it means each and every one of the class. That might be immoral. But generalization as such is not an immoral act. It's a rational act. I mean, one of the most outrageous statements probably to modern ears in the Bible is in Titus, where Paul says, as one of their own poets says, all Cretans are liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. Well, is that an immoral statement on the part of Paul? I don't think so. I mean, I wasn't there to assess Cretan culture, but I assume that the reason he quotes that is because it was a recognized characteristic of the culture that the Cretans themselves had created that those things were roughly true. We rely upon, we depend upon, our survival sometimes depends upon making generalizations. Such and such a group of people are dangerous, we think. Why? Because each and every one of those people, that set of people are dangerous necessarily? Well, no, of course not. But I don't want to find out after I'm dead. So we generalize in order to make sense of our world. Obviously, when I make the comments I do about evangelicalism, I'm generalizing. As a general rule, it seems to me that the characteristic of evangelical culture is such that the views that's going to predominate is a view that's informed by a culture that's alien to and inimical to the understanding of the gospel that Jesus and the apostles taught. Now, is my generalization right or wrong? Well, that I leave for you to decide. I don't know. And I'm not claiming any prophetic authority here. I don't know. I'm just making a judgment call. And if you want, we can, again, I'm going to leave this to you, but if you want, we can explore some examples of the kind of thing that I have in mind, but I won't take the time to do that right now. Okay, so let's look at the chart here. What I've tried to do is, this chart is structured around what I'm calling the Pharisaical paradigm. What I'm including as the new paradigm are the antithetical sorts of perspectives that you see taught by Jesus. So if I were to start out to give Jesus' paradigm for the world, I might structure it and organizing it differently. But my purpose in this chart is to try to capture the Pharisees' paradigm and show how Jesus' teaching answers that paradigm. So the first one, the first characteristic element of the spiritual paradigm of the Pharisees, a person stands to be blessed by God with the ultimate blessing if and only if he is worthy of that blessing. Now, I just put it blessed by God with the ultimate blessing because ultimately their way of thinking would have thought in terms of the promise to Abraham and the blessing of Abraham rather than eternal life. When Jesus and the apostles come along, they begin to think of that in terms of and speak of that in terms of eternal life because that's what they understand to be the ultimate blessing. But just so I don't prejudice their view as including some of the teaching of Jesus, I put it, they stand to be blessed by God with the ultimate blessing if and only if, whatever that might be, if and only if he is worthy of that blessing. Okay, in stark contrast to that, you have the teaching of Jesus in the box to the right. a person stands to be blessed by God with the ultimate blessing, eternal life, if and only if he is chosen by God to be the recipient of his mercy and grace. God's choice of such a person is indicated by the fact that he responds in belief to the truth of God's promises. The book of Romans is about that. The book of Galatians is about that. So much of the book of Hebrews is about that to a certain extent. So much of the New Testament is targeted at driving home the point that we know those people who are going to receive the grace and mercy of God because when you proclaim the promises of God to them, they believe them rather than reject them. That very simple, straightforward reality. But notice the stark contrast between these two elements of each paradigm. The Pharisees honestly, sincerely believed that by doing what they were doing and living the life they were living, they were inherently and intrinsically worthy of God's blessing. And in fact, later we're going to see, I can put it in terms of deserving of God's blessing, because they had attained and manifest a level of righteousness that was meritorious. You know, they deserved and earned and merited this blessing that God had available for mankind. They deserved it. Jesus, on the other hand, is saying that's not so. Who are the people who are going to receive the blessing that God has in store for mankind? Simply those people that he chooses out of his grace and out of his mercy. They don't deserve it. They haven't earned it. They haven't attained to it. They haven't achieved to it. They haven't merited it. Any way you want to cut it, it doesn't belong to them, but it's going to be given to them anyway. It's not right that they be given it, but God is willing to violate that which is right in the direction of the goodness of his grace and mercy to do the good thing of giving them this blessing anyway. And then how do we know who it is that is receiving the invisible reality of God having chosen them for grace and mercy? By the concrete, objective, visible fact that they respond positively and with acceptance of the promise of God for the salvation. Those are incompatible perspectives on life. One is saying you do deserve, you have earned it, you are worthy of it. The other is saying no, you are not worthy of it. It comes another way. And some of these other boxes here are going to spell that out even further. Okay, let's move to the second row. The Pharisees: a person is worthy of the ultimate blessing of the eyes in the ultimate blessing in the eyes of God if he keeps God's law. Okay. In contrast, Jesus says a person will receive the ultimate blessing if he keeps God's law, but not because such a person is worthy. Keeping God's law is not sufficient to make one worthy in the eyes of God. So in the light of the first box, the Pharisees are right insofar as they link our receiving the blessing with keeping the law. It is the law keepers who will get blessed. But the law keepers get blessed not because law keeping makes one worthy. It's just there's a correlation, but it's not a matter of deserving or meriting or being worthy of it. Okay, the third row. The touchstone that will determine whether a person is to be blessed by God or to be cursed by God is the matter of what he thinks about the law of God. If by his actions he embraces and keeps the law of God, he will be blessed. So in the Pharisaical paradigm, they understood this very, very significant event in Jewish history, the giving of the law on Mount Sinai, and they basically saw that event of the giving of the law at Mount Sinai as this touchstone in human existence. What a human being does with that will determine whether they will be blessed or whether they will be cursed. Those who take the law seriously, take it on and keep it, will be blessed. Those who don't do so will be cursed. When Jesus comes along, he suggests that that's not really right. The touchstone is not the law. The touchstone is something else. And the box to the right. The touchstone that will determine whether a person is to be blessed by God or to be cursed by God is the matter of what he thinks about Jesus of Nazareth. If by his actions one shows that he embraces Jesus' claim that he is the Messiah and that he embraces the truths taught by Jesus, then he will be blessed. So a radically different answer to the question of what does this all hinge on? It doesn't hinge on my response to the law. Everything hinges on my response to Jesus of Nazareth. And so Jesus is coming along and sweeping away centuries of religious teaching when he comes and puts himself in the place of the law. Next row. The Pharisees say a person's attitude toward the law is seen in his attention to its detail. The one who truly keeps the law is the one who observes the law in meticulous detail. In a number of places in the Gospels that we could go to see this, but Matthew 23 is probably most noteworthy. Jesus says to them, you tithe dill and mint and cumin, and okay, well, you should, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law. I can't remember what list he gives there, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law. There's just something in human beings, there's something in the human heart where we gravitate toward this kind of meticulous detail as being the symptom and the evidence of my earnestness and my seriousness. Jesus has a very, very different take on the law. We're going to see that in the two accounts coming up next week where he's talking about keeping the Sabbath. To the right, the box to the right. A person's attitude toward the law is seen in his attention to its essential core. The one who truly keeps the law is the one who sincerely seeks to conform his actions to the core of its substance and purpose. Authentic desire to keep the law is significantly more important than meticulous attention to detail. A person, as Matthew 23 points out, as Jesus is pointing out in Matthew 23, a person can give meticulous attention to detail and not have a heart that loves God and wants to honor his covenant at all. All you're doing is wanting to keep the meticulous detail. But as the prophets keep telling Israel, your heart is far from me. Your heart can be far from God, and yet your heart can be very much in the particulars of the rules that you want to follow. Jesus is inverting that. He's saying, you know what? I think God will leave a little room to move on the details. What he wants is your heart. And a person who loves God, wants to know God, is seeking God, is striving to establish that relationship with God by honoring his covenant in the best way that he knows how to do, that's a person who's right with God, even though in the very process of doing that, he blows it on the details. Paul in Romans quotes a passage out of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, as you remember, is this sermon that Moses is giving Israel. He's going to have to stay behind, but Israel's about to go into the land. And he's giving them this very last sermon that kind of summarizes where they stand in relationship to God and what they are to do when they go in the land. And he lays out all of what he calls the statutes and judgments and ordinances and, you know, precepts and whatever else this day. Be careful to do them in the land, he says, so that things will go well with you. But at the end of this message, where he's laid out quite specifically some things that they're supposed to remember to do, and you can, you know, your heart goes out to the Israelites because, okay, wait a minute. Do I tie ossifrages in my hair and not eat curls, or what? What is it that you want me to do? I mean, all this detail that is symbolic and is not intuitive. It doesn't really necessarily make sense morally that you would want me to do all this stuff. So how am I supposed to remember all this stuff? And Moses, in anticipating that, he says, don't say in your heart, who will go across the sea and hear this word and bring it to me and teach it to me so that I can understand? Or don't say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven and bring the word down? Or who will ascend into the abyss to bring, or whatever. I don't remember what all he says. But the point is, he's recognizing that remembering all the detail of this law is going to be very, very difficult. But Moses says, what should you say? But the word is near you. It is in your mouth. It is in your heart. And I think what he's saying is the meticulous detail is not what God is interested in. If you will give God your heart, and if you will do what in your heart you know is appropriate, namely to know God, to be grateful to Him as your creator and your maker, to seek to love Him, if you will simply do those things, all the details will take care of themselves. It's not going to be a problem. Your transgressing the details will not be a problem to God if He has your heart. Well, that's the perspective that Jesus brings to the law in the Gospels and in His teaching, is that all the law is doing is establishing a covenant that you are to keep with God that tests the condition of your heart, not the condition of your memory. It's not a good memory that God is going to honor. It's a good heart that God is going to honor. And if you are earnest and authentic in your desire to demonstrate your respect and honor for God by honoring His covenant, that's all God asks of you. He's not asking anything more. Well, that perspective is very different than the perspective of the Pharisees, who believe that the righteousness is in the details. You don't dare violate or transgress any one iota of the law, because that would constitute you as unrighteous. Okay, next row. A person is worthy of the ultimate blessing in the eyes of God if he is righteous. If you are worthy or if you're keeping the law, Pharisees simply equated worthiness and keeping the law with righteousness. So it's simply a restatement of everything that's gone above in different terms. Jesus, by way of contrast, says a person is worthy of the ultimate blessing in the eyes of God if he is righteous. That's true. But no human being other than Jesus is truly righteous. Therefore, no human being is worthy of the ultimate blessing. So whereas the Pharisee believed that righteousness was doable, accessible, and attainable, Jesus is saying that's not the case. Righteousness is not in the sense in which the Pharisees mean it. The next row, for the Pharisees, righteousness in the eyes of God, and we could add, and love for God, consists of and manifests itself in conformity to the demands of the divine law. That is, it consists of conformity to the rules of right practice and behavior. So the demands of the law, the Pharisees reduced to rules that you keep. By way of contrast to the right, righteousness in the eyes of God, and therefore love for God, consists of and manifests itself in an inward love for God and a desire to please Him by meeting the requirements of the law. But righteousness itself does not consist primarily in conformity to the rules of right practice and behavior. More fundamentally, it consists in the inward reality of love for God, and the emphasis being on the inward reality. So it's related to what I was saying before. What God is after, what does God demand in the law? Not external, outward, superficial conformity of my behavior and actions. What God demands is a certain state of heart, a certain state of inwardness, a certain state of being inside. That's what God demands. And if you give Him that, that's having kept the law and constituted as righteousness in the eyes of God. Okay, the next line, righteousness in the eyes of God consists of conformity to the mores, values, and practices of Pharisaical tradition and culture. So not only do we have the demands of the law reduced to rules, but they are rules that are enforced and we are instructed in and enculturated in by imbibing the tradition and culture that the Pharisees themselves have created. So we don't go to the law itself to derive our rules fundamentally. We fundamentally already know what these rules are, having grown up with and around Pharisees who have taught us what righteousness looks like. This this is really fundamental to understanding Phariseeism. Why is it that the Pharisees got upset that this disciples of John and the Pharisees fasted and prayed and the disciples of Jesus didn't? Because everybody knows a righteous person practices the kind of piety that they teach. And the fact that the disciples of Jesus don't look pious according to that standard of piety means they can't possibly be righteous. They're not following the rules that define righteousness as the Pharisees understand that. Why do the Pharisees get upset that Jesus and his disciples have gone to a party with tax gatherers and their ilk and their friends? Because everyone knows that a righteous person just flat out wouldn't be caught dead in such a place. So he's violating and breaking all of their cultural expectations about what righteousness really ought to look like. Well, where's that coming from, though? Is it a demand of the law that you not dine with tax gatherers? No, of course not. But you have all these expectations and pictures of righteousness that you have simply absorbed from the culture that the Pharisees have created. Jesus, on the other hand, says righteousness in the eyes of God is not mere conformity to the mores, values, and practices of Pharisaical tradition and culture. The locus of true righteousness is deeper and sometimes other than the mere appropriate behavior. Not that he will necessarily have any trouble with engaging in appropriate behavior, as the situation demands, but it's not righteousness. Being appropriate is not righteousness. Moral and religious and cultural propriety is an entirely different concept than moral righteousness, righteousness in the eyes of God, being acceptable in the eyes of God. They're not the same thing. And I can't stress that enough, because having grown up in conservative Bible-believing culture, it took me years to understand the distinction between those two things. I just took it for granted. It was just obvious as the nose on my face, that righteous people look like Baptists. There's just no question. Okay, following up on that then, the Pharisees would say, no person whose behavior is inappropriate, that is, lacks social propriety, can be considered righteous. Now, it seems to me all of us are tempted to apply this standard all the time. There are people whose spirituality we question because of the way they're dressed, the way they wear their hair, the particular choice, colorful vocabulary that comes out of their mouth, the stuff they stick in their mouth, the stuff they stick in their ears, all kinds of things that raise red flags for us. How can they be authentically and earnestly lovers of God, seekers of God, and do that, or look like that, or act like that? Seems to me all the time we're making those kinds of judgments. It's an incredible temptation. Well, the Pharisees not only did it, but they felt they didn't even flinch at doing that. They felt totally and utterly justified in that. By contrast, since the locus of true righteousness is deeper than mere appropriate behavior, it is intrinsically possible for a person to be truly righteous whose behavior lacks social and religious propriety. That's why Jesus could have, when you think about the people that he made his disciples, they were not, none of them were Pharisees, interestingly enough. You had Simon the Zealot on the one hand, who was a political radical. You had Matthew the tax collector, who couldn't be politically further apart. I mean, they were arch enemies of one another, if you will. Some of Simon the Zealot's ilk are the kind of people that stuck daggers in the hearts of people of Matthew's ilk. The Sicarii, a group of radical zealots, were people whose main cause was to assassinate Jews who were collaborating with the Romans. Well, Simon the Zealot was on that end of things. Matthew was the kind of person who got killed by people like Simon the Zealot. So they look very, very, very different in terms of the outward trappings and culture and cultural assumptions and political assumptions of their lives. The core of the disciples were fishermen. I don't know. I can't tell you what it was like to be a fisherman in those days, but it's very possible that they were relatively rough people, coarse, religiously coarse people. Their language, their interactions and so on were not the polite sort of stuff that religious people are supposed to do. I don't know. We just don't have any perspective on that. But what you don't have is anyone called to be a disciple of Jesus because of their religious respectability. I don't see any example of that here. Jesus looked deeper, was looking at something more fundamental than just the superficial trappings on their life. Okay, on the opposite page, for the Pharisees, the most important and the most distinctive characteristic of righteousness in the eyes of God is religious piety. That is devotion to religious acts and observances. It's really striking when you read the parable that Jesus tells about the Pharisee and the tax gatherer going to the temple to pray. And when you read the Pharisee's prayer, God, I thank you, notice, I'll come back to that. God, I thank you that I am not like other men. And then he lists a bunch of people that he's not like. And he doesn't say, I'm not like the adulterer because I'm faithful to my wife, and I'm not like the murderer because I haven't killed anybody recently. I mean, he doesn't say that. He says, I'm not like other men. I fast and pray. And he trots out his religious qualifications. Very interesting. Why would he trot out his religious piety? Because I think religious piety was supreme within Phariseeism. If you were religious, you were righteous. And yeah, you had to be moral too, but the really big deal was to be religiously pious. Jesus, on the other hand, the right-hand column, religious piety, that is devotion to religious acts and observances, is not intrinsically desired by nor valued by God. Hence, it is not the most important and most distinctive characteristic of righteousness in the eyes of God. The most important and distinctive characteristics of righteousness in the eyes of God are a commitment to moral goodness and an inward and real love for God. Give God that and can the religiosity and you're fine, I think is what Jesus would say. Very, very much at odds with the perspectives and values of the Pharisees. By the way, the Pharisee's prayer reminds me too, with respect to all these things, when we seek to ask, who are we more like in evangelical Bible-believing culture today? Who are we more like? We need to judge that not by what we say. I mean, we've all read the Bible. We all know that you can't get away with saying we're justified by works and not by faith, and sound like you have read the Bible and know what you're talking about. You can't say that. You can't say, I'm not sinful and God accepts me only by his grace and mercy. I mean, you've got to say that. There's no way you can escape that in the Bible. But it's one thing to say it as a part of your theology. It's another thing to have it fixed in your attitudes such that the actions, the perspectives, your relationship to other people is actually controlled by that attitude. That's how you know what somebody really believes. Not what they say, but what they do with their belief. The Pharisee is saying, God, I thank you that I am not like other sinners. Are we to applaud him for his theologically correct dependence upon his Creator and his gratitude toward his Creator? I don't think so. That's just theological fluff. He doesn't mean that for a second. God ought to be thanking him to have him on his side, is the actual attitude of his heart. So he knows the right thing to say, but it doesn't come from an attitude embedded deep in his being that really believes that. In the next line, religious piety is more important than kindness and compassion toward others. Jesus called, in contrast, Jesus says kindness and compassion and other weightier matters of the law are more important than religious piety. Jesus calls the Pharisees on that a number of times. You people would let somebody die in a pit before you'd violate the Sabbath. And implicit in that is there's something wrong with this picture. He doesn't think that gets it. The next row, conformity to the rules of right practice and behavior is measured by one's overt outward actions. That is, conformity to one's behavior to the rules of right practice and behavior is sufficient to constitute somebody a righteous person. In contrast, Jesus says no to that. Conformity of man's overt behavior to the rules of right practice and behavior is not sufficient to constitute someone a righteous person. Authentic righteousness is a matter of an inward conformity to the dictates of the law, not merely an outward conformity. The righteous person is the one who desires to emulate God's goodness, not the one who seeks to conform his behavior to prescribed rules of righteousness. And that's crucial. A person can, for any number of reasons, be willing to follow rules, but not love goodness. What God is wanting from those people who are desiring to keep his law and respect his law are people who desire goodness. They want to emulate the very goodness of God himself. And if you do that, the rules become, at best, mere guides to your action, but they don't dictate and necessitate your action. You do what's good, not what's according to the rules. The Pharisees would take that so far as to say, no man can be considered unrighteous who has done all that the rules of righteousness require. Jesus, by contrast, says, a man cannot justly be considered righteous merely because he has done all that the rules of righteousness require. Such a man may indeed be unrighteous. The Pharisees say in the next line, the one who appears righteous, the emphasis is on appears, the one who appears righteous because his overt actions conform to the rules of right practice and behavior is the one who is righteous. Righteousness for the Pharisees is ultimately merely a matter of appearance. There's a good example. I doubt if you pose that to them in that way, they would say, yeah, it's merely a matter of appearance. I don't think they would say that. You've got to be pretty stupid, I think, to say that. So I don't think they would say that, but that's the real attitude of their heart. So much so that their actions were focused on, driven by, and directed to the goal of appearing righteous. As Jesus points out, you know, they would, as some of them, as they would go to give alms at the temple, would hire people to come and blow a trumpet before they gave their alms. Because this was really about being acknowledged under having your righteousness appear to other people. That's the whole goal for them in the real attitude of their heart, regardless of what they might say. Jesus says, the one who appears righteous because his overt actions conform to the rules of right practice and behavior is not necessarily a righteous person. I've already said this for the next line. The focus of one's spiritual and religious life must be to appear righteous through external conformity to the rules of right practice and behavior. Jesus says the focus of one's spiritual and religious life must be the attainment of true inward righteousness. The next line. The righteous person will respond to moral or religious failure in others by condemning it. Again, this is a temptation that I feel it. I imagine you can relate to this, that there actually comes a point in our life where we feel some kind of moral and spiritual obligation to point the condemning finger at somebody else and make sure that we're being clear that we condemn you for what you've done because it's a matter of my righteousness. It's a matter of my spirituality. But Jesus actually taught the opposite of that. The righteous person will respond to moral or religious failure in others with mercy and forgiveness. Why? Because we're wanting to emulate the goodness of God, and God has made it clear that his goodness incorporates and includes mercy, compassion, and forgiveness toward failures, toward moral failure. And we need to do likewise. But we're torn. because there's something in us that gravitates toward that position that I need to distance myself from the failure, moral failure and unrighteousness of other people. I need to make it clear that I am other than and separate than. Jesus didn't have any such impulse. Fairly self-confident in his righteousness, he wasn't afraid of the unrighteousness of others and could reach out and forgive it and show compassion toward it. The next line, the person whose life conforms to the rules of right practice and behavior deserves the ultimate blessing of God, underlining the word deserves. And again, this is a question of your real attitude, not what you say about it. I could easily stand up here and say, I don't deserve eternal life. Because I know I have to. I've read the Bible. I know that's the right answer. But what is the real attitude of my heart? That's an entirely different question. Deep inside, I may very well feel like I deserve the eternal life that God is promising. But Jesus, on the other hand, is saying the person whose life conforms to the rules of right practice and behavior does not deserve the ultimate blessing of God. There's nothing about my righteousness, nothing about my love for God, nothing about my desire to emulate his goodness. As good as all that stuff is, and as right as all that stuff is, it doesn't make me deserving. It doesn't make me worthy because it's not complete enough. It's not full enough. It's not pure enough. It's tainted by the reality of my own moral brokenness and depravity. And because I am broken and depraved, I'm already ruled out as deserving. I don't deserve anything God is going to bless me with. Next line, the person whose behavior conforms to the rules of right practice and behavior is not an unrighteous sinner. He is what he ought to be in the attitude, maybe not the language and theology, but the attitude of Phariseeism. For Jesus, the person whose behavior conforms to the rules of right practice and behavior is nevertheless an unrighteous sinner. He is not what he ought to be. His righteousness is not deep and inward, but superficial and artificial. The person who is truly righteous does not believe of himself that he is deserving of the ultimate blessing. Even if his behavior conforms to the rules of right practice and behavior, he does not want to be the person that in fact he is. He wants to be changed. So, I used to be a card-carrying Pharisee who, in all honesty, I can say, spent a lot of time patting myself on my back for how morally successful I was and superior I was compared to all the other people around me. What I think I have over the years learned from Jesus is, you didn't have a clue about yourself, Jack. And I honestly and authentically want to be different now. I don't want to be the person I am. I want to be better than the person I am. More deeply and profoundly and authentically good. Not just someone who hungers and thirsts to be good, but someone who is good, who can be spontaneously good, naturally good, where being good will come as natural to me as breathing. That's what I would love to be now, I think. But there's no way I can honestly look at my life and think I'm anywhere close to that. And that's the perspective that Jesus is taking to this thing. Whereas the Pharisee's attitude was, I've pretty much arrived. I've pretty much kept all the rules, so I'm pretty much there. And Jesus thinks they're as blind as can be. The next line. For the Pharisees, there is a correlation between social respectability and righteousness and divine approval. From the Pharisee's perspective, if you are acceptable to decent religious people, if they embrace you and accept you, then that's pretty much the equivalent of God favoring you. That comes into play a lot in our culture, again, because we often appeal to the popularity of a certain perspective or book or teaching or preacher or teacher or religious figure, that because of their popularity, there must be something right about what they're doing. But again, it seems to me Jesus takes exactly the opposite perspective on that. There is no correlation between social religious respectability on the one hand and righteousness and divine approval on the other. Indeed, the truly righteous person will more likely be judged to be lacking in respectability. Or go to the next line down. the righteous person is the one whose righteousness causes him to be rejected and persecuted by others. That's a very clear theme in Jesus' teaching, as opposed to the Pharisees. The righteous person is the one whose righteousness makes him well received and respected by others. We have to do something with that. We can't have it both ways. Either the truly righteous people are going to be rejected for their righteousness, or they're going to be really popular and well received because, after all, they are righteous. But you got to choose. It can't be both ways. Jesus seems to clearly come down on the side of persecution. If they hated the teacher, he said, you can bet they'll hate the disciple. And then finally, the Pharisees, the appropriate response to human weakness and failing is contempt. If my following the rules makes me deserve the ultimate blessing and makes me deserving, then anyone who fails ought to be treated with, is undeserving and therefore treated with contempt. Jesus instead said the appropriate response to human weakness and failing is pity and compassion. Okay. I'm not presuming that that's an exhaustive list. We could probably fill out even more particular details of the Pharisaical paradigm and see a contrast with Jesus. This was just off the top of my head, some of the themes that I think I've seen in the New Testament and the Gospel. But I think it gives a sense for what I'm trying to suggest, that I think what's behind Jesus' parable about the incommensurability of the Pharisaical paradigm and his paradigm is the kind of stuff he's talking about here, how incompatible the right-hand column is with the left-hand column on this sheet. So in the time that we have left, I thought it would be good to just open it up to you, and you tell me what you think. My fear, and let me put it in terms of a fear, my fear is that on the broader scale, evangelical culture out here looks more like the attitudes of the Pharisees than the attitudes of Jesus. Now, I'd love to be wrong, and argue with me if you want to, or you can say what you need to support me in that. Let me just make one last comment about that. There are dozens of evangelical leaders out there that I love. I love what they contribute to my thinking. I love what they have to say. I like how they say it and so on. But we have to remember they're a relatively small sample. Why do I love them? Well, I think I love them because they sound a little bit different than what strikes me to be the actual mainstream characteristic of the culture at large. It's a big, vast nation out there with a lot of people who are creating this culture. It's not just a few isolated spokesmen that we listen to. So I'm not condemning those dozens of evangelical leaders out there who are self-identified evangelicals that might get your attention and listen to them and benefit from them. I dare say probably the reason you benefit from them is because they sound different than the rest of the culture that they identify with. So I'm not condemning them. I'm not for a second saying that because somebody calls himself an evangelical, you can't listen to him. I mean, I call myself an evangelical sometimes. That's not my point. My point is not to poke at individual people. It's the culture at large. So, your comments.
Yes. I would like to speak to what you have touched upon in the last couple of Sundays, last Sunday and today. I think it's great, and I don't think you have to apologize for anything or defend any of the observations about culture in general. When I was out in the field, a priest came out in a chopper and said a little rosary for about five kids in our platoon back in 1968. And most of us just sat back in our foxholes and laughed because there was no rhyme or reason. What this fellow had had become a victim of is the notion that the Pharisees historically had become a victim of, and that is that the form became welded to substance. And through this, you know, the confessional booth really appeals, I believe, to the sinful nature, in that we want to go to church on Sunday to get our whipping, and then we go home during the week and do a bunch of sins, and then come back to church and get our whipping. The focus, even in the evangelical culture, has fallen into this trap, I believe, having been with religious leaders in church and so on all my life, because having gone to seminary myself, but having been a prison chaplain, the Pharisaical notion is there continually, even at my own, in my own life, because the flesh loves it. But I believe what is the solution is when the evangelical church comes back to the notion about preaching not what we have to do for God, but what God has already done for us. Because Jesus is our exemplar, not our example. Nobody can be Christ. Christ is the alone is our righteousness, and that righteousness is complete. When his last words on the cross were, "It's finished," and that's it. There's no working for God. Growing up in Christian homes, there's always this zeal to well, we got to please God, we've got to do this, and so on. Beware lest God's up there. It's as though the picture of God is painted as one who is wringing his hands out over every little sin we commit. And that's a bunch of bull. It is. It doesn't work. The focus on church every Sunday when believers get together, and you know, Augustine says don't uproot the tares because the wheat will go with it. In other words, let anybody come. But what believers I know are hungry to hear is what God has done for us. What is the substance? What is the substance of the gospel? For example, the writer in Hebrews starts, his beginning point is God. And the end point is God. It's his sovereignty. And the key to that sovereignty is the righteousness of Christ alone, his life, not our life. What he has done, his death, his resurrection. And the Pharisees, what happened was, you know, in studying this whole historical bit, when they came back from Babylon, they had absolutized Deuteronomy 6:4, which says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." They absolutized that one, and as a consequence, when the promise did come in the form of the Messiah, Jesus Christ, they couldn't accept it. They were all set up to reject anybody that was not a Messiah of their own absolutized form. And this is what the evangelical church has done with form. You got it all the way from the 60s. I remember in seminary, one of my assignments was to go out and do an evaluation on Bill Gothard. Well, people love that stuff. He packed the arena. He made his living by it. And people will hire a pastor if that pastor has solutions for their youth, so to speak, on how to live, rather than who God is. They put the cart before the horse. Anyway, I just want to say that because when I come here, we've been looking in Eugene for the last 15 years for a place to fellowship with believers who are more interested in the sovereignty of God and who God is and who is God, rather than how we've got to live our lives. And I don't know how that's going to come about, but we're even trapped here because of our own flesh. We start getting on the particulars rather than focusing on who God is. What I'm saying is let's get with that.
Okay.
I don't want anything that I say to be construed as disagreeing with everything you said this morning. I think I can agree with everything. So if it sounds like I'm disagreeing, I'm not. So ask me to clarify or something. But
do you believe in the law of non-contradiction?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I don't think you would say, and I don't think you were claiming that the Jews were not under obligation to keep the whole law, all of those non-moral or purely religious requirements of the law, were you? I mean, I went and looked in Deuteronomy, and you know, when Moses gets toward the end of his extended sermon, he seems pretty careful to be pretty inclusive about the requirements.
Things like make sure that you keep all the statutes.
Yeah, yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. No, that's true, but I am. We'll look at this next week in the passages coming up, because I think what we're going to see Jesus saying is when Moses commanded them to keep them all, he didn't mean by that what you Pharisees have taken that to mean. So with the kind of excruciatingly agonizing attention to meticulous details, that's not what Moses had in mind. That's what I will argue that Jesus is saying. So in that sense, yes, I am saying that they didn't need to keep them all. What they need to do is keep the covenant at all, not keep all the covenant. The complaints of the Pharisees is you haven't taken it seriously at all. God is able and willing to forgive the transgressions of the details if you're actually attempting it. But you guys as a nation haven't even attempted it. Is that?
I think I totally agree. I think the Israelites in general and the Pharisees perhaps in particular traded, well, like a lot of the points that you made on that chart, they traded a heart that was right before God for all of those external religious practices. I guess I still wouldn't be comfortable saying that the Jews were not under obligation to keep every detail of the law. And in fact, when they violated, there were sacrifices that they had to go through to.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with that. Sure. That was part of the contract that they had with God.
Thank you.
The evangelical history part of my brain is identifying with the Pharisees, and there's a certain fear I think we have of saying, well, it's what's in your heart that counts, right? We have a seemingly capricious God who says, yeah, David, go ahead and eat the showbread. I know it's against the law, but go ahead and do it. But by gosh, if you touch that ark, even to keep it from falling on the ground, you're dead, right? And the Pharisees look at this and say, then don't break any rules. You know, don't break any rules, because it's a slippery slope and you never know when, you know, God's going to say, oh, well, this one I just happen to, you know, hold more dear than that one. In my evangelical mind, I hear, I remember feeling the threat of someone who says, well, as long as you're a believer in trying, because the first thing we would jump to is, oh, well then, okay, so homosexual marriage and cheating on your taxes and being a communist and all that's okay as long as you name the name of Christ, you know, as long as you're sincere. I understand the rule-keeping mentality. I understand the safety of that and the loneliness of letting every person be their own morally accountable being and not being able to make choices for them. Now, given all that, can you revisit the scene where the Pharisees bring the quote-unquote woman caught in adultery before him? Because that's exactly what's going on. It seems to me the Pharisees are going, look, it's the law. Now, are you cavalier about the law, or are you serious about the law? Do you love God or not? Okay, so could you just kind of visit that scenario? And
why don't you do it?
Well, no, I mean, okay, is Jesus saying, as I've heard said, you know, the law is beautiful and it's good, and it was not intended to be used for things like this. So don't ask me to be a part of your little show. Was he saying that? Or was he saying, well, if God can take David's sin, you know, the king of Israel, why can't I take this woman's sin? Why can't I forgive her never saying what she did was okay. But where in the law was the provision for Jesus to just up and say, "Nah, we'll skip it"?
That's kind of a complex question, because I mean, my answer would have to be kind of complex. I'm inclined to think that part of what's going on there is Jesus' recognition of the nature of the covenant. The nature of the covenant is such that the nation of Israel can't keep the covenant by stoning one adulteress. Stoning one adulteress doesn't mean the nation is not keeping the covenant. If you're keeping the covenant, you're keeping the covenant as an entire nation, as an entire people. I think that's what's so profound about his response is, you know, whichever one among you is without sin, cast the first stone. If you guys have not, if the nation hasn't risen up and decided together to make God their God and to become his people and actually take on the covenant as a nation, then why are we playing this little game of picking on one adulteress and saying the law says stone her? Yes, if we as a nation were being the holy people that God called us to be, then we would be purging ourselves of all unrighteousness. We would be stoning blasphemers and adulterers. That's true. But I haven't seen any evidence that this is a nation that's interested in keeping the covenant. So let's stop the charade. That's how I would read that. So I think it's different. We'll look at David. The passage coming up is David eating the showbread. We'll look at that. I think that's a little different.
Why? Tune in next week. Okay, I got
it. Yeah, because I haven't studied it yet. So I'll tell you next week.
Real quick, Jack, when we talk about moral propriety and how that tends to become very murky, when it's put into the relationship of the weaker brother, and to me that's where it almost piggybacks on itself and creates a culture in and of itself, and people on one hand are going, this isn't righteousness, but I dress this way, I don't do that, I don't date girls who do X, Y, Z, all that. It's not entrenched. We wouldn't admit that it's righteousness, but it begins to take on a character and a color of its own,
mm-hmm.
and it starts to characterize a people. And I'm not really sure. I think that's more the case as far as an evangelical culture than it is, well, you know where I'm going with that.
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, it comes back to the distinction I'm making between what we say and our real attitudes. I think it's a rare evangelical who would say, you have to dress a certain way, you have to listen to a certain kind of music and so on in order to be righteous. But we look at somebody who doesn't fit that picture, and we don't say you are unrighteous because you don't fit the picture, but what we say is, there's something wrong in your relationship with Jesus. Well, it's the same thing. I mean, if there's something wrong with my relationship with Jesus, then what we're saying is, you are not the sort of person who is pleasing to him, who is acceptable to him. So we circumvent the language that we know the Bible will not allow me to use, but we adopt the attitude that the Bible is telling me don't have. Don't take that perspective. Don't equate outward external behaviors and practices with the inward righteousness that God requires of you. They're different things.
Yes. I guess what is disturbing to me is how we all start looking alike because we're afraid to offend other people. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. I mean, we don't want to go so far as to turn nonconformity into an end in itself. Cultures just do breed conformity, and that's okay. We're not being warned against forming cultures, but what we're being warned against is thinking that I can conform to my culture and then know that I'm right with God. That's where it gets downright dangerous and destructive. I've kept you over. I'm going to have to let you go. Thank you.